Okay. Lesson 6 covered a large portion of the Old Testament, didn't it? It started with the book of Numbers. You can always see in that center section that's grayed the exact chapters that were considered when the man wrote the overview that he did, when Dr. Lorenz wrote this overview. And it starts really from the time that the children of Israel left Mount Sinai after the law was given. Our last lesson was on the law of Moses. And now we're going to see a lot of history in today's period that takes us from Mount Sinai into the Promised Land, and really several hundred years of history into the Promised Land. Let's begin by putting things. I always like to have things in time for us. Does anybody remember the date of the Exodus from Egypt? Because that's kind of our starting point for today. What did the letter?
I think I'm wrong. Shortly after 1301 BC.
1301 BC is close to it. The date that I had given you, remember, is one that's easy to remember if you remember that 1776 is the founding of America, is our Declaration of Independence. The children of Israel, if you follow the Bible's chronology most exactly, you will come up with a date 1446 BC as to when they left Egypt. Now, in books, you'll read various different years, but from the study that I've done, and I think Dr. Lorenz, too, I think he had given it to us in a previous lesson, 1446 is the most accurate date you'll find if you're just using the Bible's chronology. Okay? And we learned at the beginning of this lesson that the children of Israel didn't leave from Mount Sinai until about a year after they left Egypt. So it would have been in 1445 BC when they finally left the mountain. Remember that it didn't take them that long to get there. I think within 3 months they were already at Mount Sinai. But then they spent a considerable time there. Moses was 40 days up on the mountain receiving the law from the Lord. And then, especially the ceremonial portions of the law had to be put into effect. So they had to build that tabernacle that we studied about, right? And the clothing for the priests had to be made. And everything had to be set up. The altar had to be built in order for that sacrificial system to be started. And so it was about a year after they set out from Egypt that they finally left from Sinai. The book of Numbers, it receives its name. This is the fourth book of the Old Testament, and it receives its name because twice in the book they count the people. There were censuses that were taken, and they were especially counting the number of fighting men. You can see in the second paragraph already on the first page, there were just over 600,000 men who were considered to be able to be in the military. And we had looked earlier at how if you count women and children, then you've got a group of people that's probably over 2 million traveling through the desert. So this was an awesome undertaking, an awesome mass migration. And they begin to leave from Mount Sinai, but then the complaining begins. I've given you the theme that I sometimes give for the 40 years in the wilderness, grumbling on the way to the Promised Land. It's a theme that kind of applies to us too as God's people, that we often spend our time here on earth grumbling on the way to the Promised Land, on the way to heaven. And you read this week about all of the different plagues and things that the Lord sent to them when this grumbling would just go on and on. The book of Numbers is basically that book of the Bible that tells the whole story of their wandering in the wilderness. Remember that they left from Egypt, they crossed over the Red Sea, and they spent most of those 40 years in this little tongue of land called the Sinai Peninsula that still today lies between Egypt and the land of Israel. because of the people's complaining, especially at the time that they sent out the spies, remember. Rather quickly, they got down here to the mountain and then came back up, and they sent spies out to see what the land of Canaan was like. And most of the spies came back with a report of, the people are giants there. They're huge. We'll never be able to defeat them. Let's go back to Egypt. This isn't going to work. And as a punishment for that, the Lord had them wander in the wilderness for 40 years before they finally entered into the land. Now, the book of Numbers is the book that records these 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. It even records how eventually they came up on the east side of the land. They didn't. It would have been rather easy for them to just go up the land route into Israel. At that time, it was called the land of Canaan. But the Lord ended up leading them around this way. They went through by the Moabites and the Ammonites, with whom they had battles. And they eventually entered by crossing the Jordan River. It was striking to me again as I read it this week that just as there was a crossing of a sea when they left Egypt, so when they finally entered the Promised Land, the Lord caused a similar miracle to happen where he, in this case, caused the Jordan River to stop flowing downwards, and it all flooded at a certain point and the bed dried up. They crossed over into the land of Israel, at that time known as Canaan, and then the river began to flow again down into the Dead Sea. Our second book that we studied for this week in the focus number 2 was the book of Deuteronomy. Just before they entered into the Promised Land, Moses had a final farewell with them. And this book is unique in that it's a long sermon that's given by Moses. It's almost completely the words of Moses in which he encourages them to stay faithful to the Lord. It's called Deuteronomy, which in Greek means second law. It's really two words. That's why it's so long. Because in chapter 5 of this book, Moses reviews the Ten Commandments with them. And he reviews many of the other laws that he had received on Mount Sinai in the book as well. But it's mainly an encouragement to the people to remain faithful to the Lord when they enter into the Promised Land. Remember that Moses himself did not enter into the Promised Land. He, in a moment of anger that was quite uncharacteristic of Moses, received the punishment where God said, "You will not enter into the Promised Land." So Moses just led them up to the entrance of the Promised Land, gave this final farewell, and then went up on Mount Nebo, where he died and was never seen or heard from again. It seems uncharacteristic that the Lord would be that harsh with one of his leaders. Is it because he expects more of his leaders than he does from the people in general? No real explanation is given in the book of Numbers for it. When?
I remember having to read it over about 3 times before I realized that God said to use his word, to say, but he hit it with it. I'm thinking, okay, he hit it instead of said it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was because he needed the people to see the power of his word.
Yes.
And by Moses striking it, it made it look like Moses was the one who made the water flow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was when he was striking a rock in one of those 3 episodes in the wilderness, right, where he struck the rock rather than spoke the word of the Lord. And I think you've got a good point there. And let's apply that to our lives, too. How often doesn't God just want us to speak his word, and we feel we have to go above and beyond, you know, to really convince the people or to really do the work of the Lord, right? So, similar. Then, the third book that we overviewed during this week was the book of Joshua. Joshua was the next leader after Moses' death. And he led the people in the conquering of the Promised Land. Let me see if I can get one of the maps here that has the conquest of the land and then the dividing of it into tribes. He was like a general of the army. Thought maybe I'd find one with colors, but I guess I don't. I'll pass this around later on, and it's got where all of the tribes were located once they settled down in the land of what we call today Israel. It was formerly called Canaan. There's some of the smaller tribes are up here in this area that Jesus grew up in of Galilee. But the largest ones were Manasseh, who stretched out over the Jordan River, Ephraim, those were the two sons of Joseph, and then Judah was the largest section down here where Jerusalem was. Judah, of course, was the one who had received the promise that the Savior would come from his descendants. And so this is the area, of course, where David is going to be born, and then later Jesus himself would be born. So I'll pass that around and you can take a look at that, or at any of the maps in there. The fourth book that we studied then was the book of Judges. Judges is always an intriguing book to me. It covers a long period in history, over 300 years in Israel's history. It seems that when they first landed in the Promised Land, they were not very centrally organized. During this period, they had no king. They were ruled by these judges who really, the book of Judges is very episodic. It will talk about how a certain foreign nation would invade, like sometimes it was the Midianites, and they would oppress a certain part of the land of Israel, and then a judge would arise, and he would drive the invader out. And then for a time there would be peace in the land. But then troubles would arise again, and it usually resulted because of the people going over to the false gods. God had said when he first led them into Canaan, drive the Canaanites out because they worship false gods that you're going to be tempted to want to worship. They didn't drive the Canaanites out completely, and that always became kind of a hook for them, kind of the thing that would drag them down. And then whenever they would go away from the Lord, he'd send one of these invaders in to oppress the land for a time, and then a judge would arise and drive the invader out. Some of the more famous ones were Samson and Gideon and Deborah. We'll look at them more individually when we go into the questions. And the book of Judges kind of ends in a real tawdry story about some Benjamites and a woman that is raped. It's a very sordid story, and it kind of ends with that, I believe, to show us how the children of Israel, whenever they would not let the Lord lead them, had some very sordid moments in their history. But our overview chose to end with the book of Ruth, which is a much more upbeat and hopeful story. It tells the story of a foreign woman, a woman from Moab, who gets into comes to live with the Jews. And actually, as we're going to end this week's story, we're going to find that she became one of the ancestors of the Savior, of Jesus himself. And I think that book kind of helps to counteract any idea that we might get that the other nations were not as worthy as Israel. Even though the Lord himself had told them not to intermarry with these foreign people who lived there. Actually, when the foreign people would intermarry with them, there were some of the best ending stories in this whole period in Israel's history. And I think it was God's way of showing the people that although they were his special people, they should never get the impression that they were better than other peoples. That God really, from the very beginning, intended his gospel for all nations. Gwen?
Okay, well, that leads to the question, because he gave Israelites a specific command to, when they went into the Promised Land, to destroy everybody, to wipe them out. Mm-hmm. You know,
yes.
So, and they didn't do that, you know, which caused them problems. But if they hadn't not done that, then Ruth, I guess, is God. Mm. It's not for me to try to figure that out.
Yeah. I think it's very important for us to see this as an isolated command that God gives for this very important role of setting the stage for Jesus. We certainly shouldn't take away from a section of the Old Testament like this that we would condone things like oppressing other peoples or things like genocide or anything like that. This was a very specific command, and I don't believe it was always to kill them. If the people were killed in war, that's true. But what God really wanted to do was to drive them out of the land, right? Because he had set this land aside for to be the place where the people could be fostered and the Jewish faith could grow as the time of Jesus coming approached.
I guess they miss it in the translation. They probably should
be more careful in the wording of that. I thought he was somewhat careful. I probably won't be able to.
Not him. I mean the Bible.
Oh yeah.
Because I think there was a footnote that did say not equal to, did not necessarily mean death.
That's right. Okay, so that's the overview of the section. Let's start looking at some of the application questions now. We'll start with focus number one. We always look at those on the right-hand side in the column that's headed Points to Ponder. Were there any in the first page of Points to Ponder that you'd like to discuss?
Master, is the 40 days and 40 nights and 40 years, is that literal or is that figurative?
It's literal. In the books of Moses especially, he mentions numerous times this is the history of, especially at the beginning of Genesis. So, like the 40 days and 40 nights of rain, we would take as being literal, that it really happened for 40 days and 40 nights, that the children of Israel really wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. But it is true that the numbers in the Bible take on a symbolic significance. But I think it's always important to remember that that symbolic significance came about because of the historic events that took place for 40 days or for 40 years. In the Bible, the number four is usually the number for the earth, because they would often speak of the four corners of the earth or the four points of the compass. And the number 10 was a number of completeness. You have 10 fingers and thumbs, and so most peoples will count their numbers, using a base 10 system. So there was a certain completeness that was felt to be reached by the time you got to 10. So 4 times 10 would be a completeness of the earth. This has some significance about the earth. 3, of course, is the number for God, because he being a triune God. 7 is very important in the books of Moses because of the 3 of God coming together with the earth. So, and the peoples of the earth. So the number 7 is usually the sacred number that talks about God's covenant with people when he brings himself together with people. But all of these numbers only develop these symbolical meanings after much of the history had already been recorded. And the Bible presents these things as happening in history. That it really was 40 days.
When it says that Israel was in the desert for 40 years, that means 40 years, not a very long time.
Right, exactly. I think there's even a section, is it in Numbers, where it talks about how after that 40 years, all the adults of the previous generation had died off.
That's the reason why.
Right. So all of those who were 20 years or younger before, they survived, but there's a specific passage that says all of those over 20 died. And I would think partly with just the hardships of living in the wilderness may have lowered the death rate lower than was normal.
But God said that he was not going to allow that generation that rebelled against them when they came back from the spies came back, there was that whole group, and he said that they were stiff-necked and he was not going to let them see the promised land, and they wandered for 40 years until that generation had died off.
Yeah, he specifically told it ahead of time, right?
Yeah.
before it ever happened. Good question. Any of the points to ponder on page 3? The one I starred was 6C. Nazarites gave up things to serve God better. Is it possible for a Christian to have it all and still be effective on God's behalf? Let's review, first of all, what were Nazarites to do without?
They can't shave, they couldn't drink, they couldn't touch dead things.
And don't touch a dead body, right? Don't become unclean. Touching a dead body was considered unclean. So no alcohol, the razor was not to touch their head, their beard was to grow long, their hair was to grow long, and they should not go into the mortician business.
I kind of like that. Thinking about doing that myself. Following all three of those.
Really?
Yes.
His wife looks askance.
I've seen him with a beard.
What was the purpose of these three? To focus people?
Okay.
On God. Mm-hmm. If you give up things like alcohol, how would that help you to focus on God?
Takes away a distraction.
Okay, takes away a distraction.
It's a distraction mm-hmm. for people nowadays too.
Clearer mm-hmm. thinking.
People don't think.
Yeah. Clearer thinking. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you could say not. You couldn't have it all.
Mm-hmm. That's how the question words it, right? Mm-hmm. What benefit comes from depriving yourself of something?
Humility.
Okay, a sense of humility.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Patience.
Patience, maybe, huh? You think of the fasting that would sometimes go on in Bible times, like on the Great Day of Atonement, or when Jesus fasted. Your body will keep telling you when you're fasting, give me food, and you're saying no to those impulses, right? So it's something, it causes a struggle within you, right? Where you have to deny the urges of your body.
Maybe creating discipline.
It creates discipline in a person, right? That you don't just give in to every impulse that you have.
Well, it sounds like in that he's giving each tribe a purpose. It's just not clear to me what the purpose for that tribe would be.
Keep in mind that this isn't a tribe, though. I think you might be thinking of Naphtali, huh?
Well, the Nazarites were the ones who... God chose to serve him as the firstborns of all the Israelites? Or am I getting that mixed up?
I think that's mixed up with a different idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think you might be thinking of the Levites, huh?
Levites, yeah.
Because God had originally said, give me every firstborn, but then at a certain point in the Law of Moses, he says, but you can redeem the firstborn by bringing a certain offering, and then the Levites would fulfill that role. Mm-hmm. Nazarites could be in any tribe. And it seems to have been more of a voluntary thing, where somebody might say, I want to devote myself more wholeheartedly to the Lord. It seems that sometimes people became Nazarites for life, while at other times people only took a vow like this for a certain period of their lifetime. Still in the times of Jesus, it seems that people would make these kind of vows. I don't know if you remember the story of Paul during one of his missionary journeys, where he didn't cut his hair. And he says that he took a vow to the Lord, and people have wondered whether he took the Nazarite vow. And then if you did it for just a certain period of time, when the vow period was over, then you cut your hair, and Paul took that hair to the temple in Jerusalem, and it was like an offering that he made to the Lord. So it seems like there were times where it was a temporary thing, and at other times where it was to be a lifetime thing. Samson, one of our judges for this time period, was commanded by God before he was ever born to be a Nazarite, where he was never to drink, where his hair was not to be cut. And you'll remember that he wasn't faithful to that command that God had given even before he was born. So it seems that sometimes it was a lifetime thing, and sometimes it was just for a period of time.
Could it be like like if a person were unclean and then they had to be separated from the tribe, that when they came back, maybe they decided that they didn't focus and that they wanted to become a Nazarite?
It could have come after a period of uncleanness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anna, it looked like you had something.
Does that relate to Nazareth in any way, the Nazarites?
People have often wondered, but it seems like it doesn't. Jesus in the New Testament is called a Nazarene, but not a Nazarite. It just seems like the two words are closely related. They sound alike, but they're not related. Another thing I wondered about it as I was studying was, does denying yourself the ability to have it all help you to focus on spiritual things rather than on physical things? If you have a sense, I think too many Christians in America today still view success or wealth as a sign of blessing from God, and I'm not so convinced that that's a sign of blessing from God at all. I think a lot of people just have that as a preconceived notion, and it is the thing that leads them astray. They begin to focus more on physical things, on monetary things, and they get away from God. So I wondered if that was part of it too.
Using someone as an example, that Mr. Schwann, he has it all. Wouldn't just say then, as long as he follows God's law, he could have it all. And he is, apparently.
To bring it back to our Old Testament, remember some of the most famous believers of the Old Testament were wealthy. Abraham was wealthy. Job was wealthy, although God, you know, took much of his wealth away at a certain period in his life. It's not wrong to have wealth. If the Lord blesses us with wealth, that's a good thing. Mr. Schwann, the way you're talking, Nancy, you may not be aware, he has since passed away.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He's the man who, the ice cream trucks that drive around, Schwann's Food, he was a member of the Wells. And he probably would be a good example of how doing without everything is a blessing, because he was very generous in giving much of it to the work of the Lord. So I would think even a wealthy person could practice what this Nazarite vow is about by doing without what could rightfully be yours as a way of showing God, you gave all of this to me, and I don't necessarily have to live in the lap of luxury.
But to me, having it all doesn't necessarily mean a wealth either. You know, what does having it all mean? You know, does having it all mean that, you know, you are committed to God, that you are able to have, you know, to still work with your family, work within your marriage? You know, so to me, I don't look at having it all as a material kind of a thing. I look at it being like maybe, you know, there's some part, because we're sinners, we're going to be missing some part. There's no way for us to have, and when I interpret it my way, having it all, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that helps me become a stronger Christian, knowing that there's a part of my personality and the things that I do that I still need to work on.
Well, I think having it all, too, means different things to different people, like you said. I mean, some people will feel blessed with a healthy family and a roof over their head and, you know, not necessarily the latest model car or that kind of thing, and some people don't. Unless they have more.
And how you obtain it, I think, is really important. Because, you know, it's not, like you said, it's not, on the other hand, that you things can be viewed as, well, if you're ambitious and this and that, that that's not godly. And I don't think that's true either, but I think in how you obtain it is very important. And do you obtain your, whatever it is, that, you know, if you're striving to promote yourself and do things, are you doing it honestly? Are you doing it without hurting other people? Are you doing it to help other, while you're helping other people? Or are you doing it just for yourself?
Yes.
So.
Well, an ambition, I think, goes along with God's given you a certain gift to be able to do something, so you do it the best you can.
Like you're saying, it, you know, if you do that and you're successful, what's important is And it's kind of a silly thing because you hear it all the time, but it is a certain balance. I mean, if you, you know, the more you have, the more you should be giving to other people as well. You know, it shouldn't be like, okay, well, now I'm making more, so I'm going to still give what I'm giving to the church, mm-hmm. that little amount or whatever it is. I mean, you should be making sure you're allocating things properly and giving back. I always think of the people that, I saw this special on people that became millionaires and how it ruined, you know, a lot of people's lives. Mm-hmm. But this one man who became a millionaire, it was like one of those publishers' clearinghouse things, he gave, I mean, a huge amount of it. It must have been, it was well over half of what he got. He gave back into, you know, his, not just relatives, but friends, people he'd worked with, co-workers and things. He bought them houses and just, you know, people said, he's crazy, he's giving away all of his money. But this guy, he was so happy, and out of every person that they showed, he was the one that really enjoyed his life, and people were very, in his church, I mean, he built this, he just rebuilt everything for the church and just gave so much, and I was really, it was very touching to see somebody that it didn't, they, everybody kept saying it didn't affect him, you know, it didn't change who he was as a person, because he continued to be the same giving person. Mm-hmm. It made very little difference in his life, except for the fact that he said he could still, he could give that much more to other people.
You don't really treasure something unless you're at peace with giving it up.
Yeah, that's it.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, he wasn't afraid of having someone something taken from him, too. And other people became very paranoid and would lock themselves mm-hmm. in their houses. And, you know, who's going to take something from me now? And it was a very sick state of mind mm-hmm. versus he had a very healthy state of mind. Mm-hmm. But he was also the only one out of all these folks that they showed, in my opinion, that had any basis of spirituality in his life, which was also a key, I think. So, kind of interesting. Kind of makes you think, what would have happened to me if, you know, well, we don't play the lottery, but if we did, kind of got to play to win, but what would you do?
So how would you answer then? What final answer would you give to the question? Is it possible for a Christian to have it all and still be effective on God's behalf? I think it would be difficult, but I think it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, what is all?
What is your foundation?
What is mm-hmm. your foundation?
Yeah. Your foundation is God, and mm-hmm. you know your foundation mm-hmm. is your faith, and you yeah. know that's your foundation. This is your foundation, and yeah, mm-hmm. because it directs you. Mm-hmm.
Because this is your all, right?
Right.
If this is your foundation, then you already have it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So everything else is just stuff.
Yeah.
Let stuff go.
And then you can take it or leave it.
That's right. Yeah. I've got a lot of stuff.
Okay, let's move on to the second page. Which ones would you like to ponder on page 5?
6E was, I left that blank. It was
6E?
6E, yeah.
What do the rebellions of the army, Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and the 250 community leaders teach about human nature and about living with God-pleasing discipline? Remember, this is the group that rebelled against Moses, right? Still at Mount Sinai, I believe it was,
yeah.
right? Where they did not want to follow Moses' leadership. And they ended up dying. What can we learn about living with God-pleasing discipline? About human nature and about living with God-pleasing discipline.
Well, human nature, right? I just didn't understand why they did what they did. You know? I guess that's the sinful nature. It's just so easy to go astray so fast.
Mm-hmm. I had written down a verse here, Exodus 6, no wait a second, Numbers 16:3. What did they say there again? In 16:3 it says, "They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, 'You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?'"
He said that to Moses and Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
Well, competition? Did they, you know, they didn't want Moses and Aaron to be the leaders? They wanted to be the leaders? I guess people are always fighting to be who's going to be on top.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what it comes down to, right? I had in my answer about authority too. When God gives authority to leaders within a group, you know, we live in times where question authority is, you know, one of the most famous slogans that there is, and this is a really drastic example from the Bible about what happens when you do question authority, right?
When they were jealous.
Mm-hmm.
But when something goes wrong, don't people almost always accuse the leaders?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it's out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
You figure they have control.
Yeah.
Why did they do what they did?
The individual feels powerless, so they look to the leader, and then if something goes wrong, want to blame the leader, right? Mm-hmm.
Provided for, but up until that point, everybody had what. That's why I didn't understand. I mean, they were provided for. God. I mean, he even said it as they were rebelling against Moses. We have the Lord. We have this. We have that. Well, what are you two doing up there?
Yeah. Well, what's occurring to me as I'm looking at it here, there's no dramatic event that goes before
yeah.
it,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those periods throughout the 40 years where the malcontents began to erupt in. What are you doing here? Why are you leading us in this direction? Joe?
Looking in the notes here, and it says one of these leaders, Korah,
mm-hmm.
He held high duties in the service of the Lord at the tabernacle, but he desired more. His passion was to assume the role of priest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So he totally lost focus.
Oh, yeah.
He was more concerned about himself. And
that was in, yeah. was that in your... Which verse is that?
I think it's human nature not to want to be disciplined too, because from what they said, if I'm understanding the passage you read right, they are saying we're already doing everything you wanted us to do. So why are you? Why are you trying to discipline us in this way? Is that right? Is that what they're saying? Or
I think they're just questioning the leadership.
Yeah.
Let me read all three of the first verses. Korah, son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, became insolent and rose up against Moses. With them were 250 Israelite men, well-known community leaders, who had been appointed members of the council. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" It sounds to me that it's just pecking order that's trying to be determined here, and what I hear in that one phrase there, the whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. I think they're talking about all the Israelites, right?
That's what I'm saying, is they're saying, they're already obeying you. What more do you want? I think is part of
oh.
it. It's like when you discipline your own kids and you say, and they're not doing anything wrong, but you might remind them that they're supposed to do a job or not do this so and so, and they go, "I know," you know. They're just don't. You don't have to keep telling me.
Maybe because they're on automatic.
Yeah,
like the kids. They wake up in the morning, they get the room clean, they do this, they do that. So why do we need parents?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you've told me a million times, you don't have to keep telling me.
But
they don't like the discipline.
But what's wrong in the very last question of verse 3? Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly? What's wrong with that question?
I don't understand what they're talking about, Lord's assembly.
Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly? I think, again, the
all
people
the Israelites
of Israel.
Again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think
they don't want a leader.
They're forgetting that God set them above the assembly.
Yeah. Yeah, Moses had gotten the call, when was it? While he was out in the desert with his father-in-law's sheep, right? And the Lord had called him to lead the people out of Egypt. And here they're making it sound like you just took this upon yourself. And I think the leadership can have its own blind side, but I would say if the people who are being led have any blind side, it's that they don't realize that their leaders aren't just, I mean, if they're God-fearing leaders, they're not just there because they want to be the leader. They're there because God has called them to do the leading. And I think in our American system, in our way of looking at things, we are so focused on equality that leaders are constantly questioned, but what right do you have to tell me what to do? Because I'm an independent American who, you know, should be able to make all of my own decisions. Well, 2 million people in the wilderness can't each go their own way and make their own decision without having leaders. That would be something that's very expensive.
Part that went wrong too is not reading, you know, every word means something. And when our documents say that all men are created equal, it doesn't say that the outcome is equal or that we're equal now, we were created equal. It's sort of the same thing though, you know, words mean things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good example too of that, that the truth was there, all people are created equal, and yet the guys who wrote it had slaves, which was not right, right? And so there is a truth, let's apply it to God's word now, there's a truth about God's word, but human beings who get called to do the leadership are sinners. And they're going to abuse the power that they have, or the leadership. And they should be called to account if they're doing something wrong. But I'm not seeing anything in this account that Moses and Aaron were doing that were was abusing their power.
These guys just went off the deep end.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to answer your question about what the words are, like in the Constitution, I think what Americans forget is that the Constitution was not written by God.
Right.
It was written by men.
Mm-hmm.
It's fallible. It's
yes.
fallible. And yes, we can amend it and we can make changes to it, which we have done. It's not the Bible.
Right.
You can't add and you can't take away.
That's right. That's right. That's part of the system. You can add to it. And the Bible, you can't.
But I think there was a certain inspiration that was given to these people in writing the Constitution.
They were trying to make things...
Because there's no constitution that has ever been written that has equaled, you know, what our constitution does.
As Americans, we probably would see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a wisdom to it, but again, I choose my words wisely.
Yeah.
The Bible is inspired.
Right.
But
yeah.
That's
no,
a different.
Some inspiration.
Yeah. Inspiration like we use it today, you know, where you get a wise idea, you know, mm-hmm. and you put it into writing.
Most of the leaders at the time were Masons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they've got their symbols all over Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And I think another thing here is that human nature is, I'm thinking that I can do it. And what I learn about God-pleasing discipline, and I interchange discipline with teaching, is that I know that God will teach me the right way to do things
mm-hmm.
versus my human nature way of doing things.
Yes.
I always trip over myself and you were talking to me but I didn't hear.
Yeah.
And that's what I keep in mind, is that I keep discipline and teaching is the same to me.
Yes. Yeah, we want to inject our personality into it, right? And I'll fix that situation. And what God is usually trying to do is refine us over a long period of time, where he's trying to teach us things like patience and self-discipline. And we're not hearing him, like Joe says, because we want to get in there and act and fix the situation. Let's go on to another one. Any other ones you want to take on page 5? about page 7?
What about 6J?
6J, if your life of service came to an end today, what advice would you give to those people you would be leaving behind? Remember that this question was generated because at this point Moses was near the end of his life. He's giving this final speech, the book of Deuteronomy, to the people. And now he's handing over the reins to Joshua. What advice would you give if you were in a similar situation?
I think I would encourage them to study the Word. Mm-hmm. That's the one advice. And study it. I mean, not just, you know, as I said, not just listen to it.
Yes.
Really study it.
Study
and think
it.
About it.
Yeah. Study the Word. Excellent advice.
Pray for faith and guidance and be an example.
Okay. Pray for faith and guidance and be an example.
I said, shape up and follow God's laws.
Okay, shape up and follow God's laws.
Thinking of my children.
Well, Moses does that in Deuteronomy, right? He repeats the law to them. The Ten Commandments, it means the second law. So he does the same thing. A thought that occurred to me was, especially for Moses, having gone through the wilderness for 40 years and seeing the manna come every morning and the quail come and the striking a rock and the water coming out and when the people complained and then they were bit by those poisonous vipers and raising up the bronze snake, how faithful God is to us. I would want to remind people, just think how faithful he's been throughout your life. Just think how faithful he's been throughout history, creating this world so perfectly. And when we fell into sin, redeeming us. How faithful he's been to every one of his promises. Now always trust in those promises. Never despair or get discouraged, because God's proven himself. Just, it kind of goes along with what Anna's saying. Just always look in that Word, be in it, and be reminded of the many times he's rescued his people. And that will give you the confidence to always go forward.
I found that the author was very elegant the way he explained that their sandals didn't wear down, their clothes didn't wear down.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like, there was 2 billion people out there, you know, and that totally probably went past them, totally went by them, mm-hmm. you know, for 40 years, you know, they were wandering around and they didn't have to make new clothes and change, you know, and make new shoes.
How many miracles yeah. were going on, you know, every day,
every day.
As they mm-hmm. traveled? Yeah.
Well, you know, they did that walk with the Bible on the TV, and the man who was doing the research work for the story climbed Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm climbing in these comfortable shoes, well supported, and Moses went up there in sandals.
Yeah. Yeah. Living in tents, no air conditioning, no camper. Joe?
No, I think it's important that you stay in the Word. I think it's also important that you know who Jesus is and that you obey Jesus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the advice I would give people.
Good. Okay, any others on 7?
Can I just ask 6L briefly, because I have a really hard time answering that myself.
Yeah, that's one of the main questions that comes up, right? Why does a loving God permit disasters to happen? Mm-hmm. Remember, they had quite a few disasters that happened along the way, right? I mentioned the one about the being bit by the serpents, and many of them died from the poison of the serpents. Why would God allow something like that to happen?
Isn't it because there's still sin in the world? And as long as there's still sin in the world, things are going to happen, mm-hmm. disasters and things. But as when we were doing our membership Bible study, one thing that I remember really vividly from that was that we were still hearing a lot about Katrina and things like that. And I forget who, somebody some person that was well known said something like, well, it was brought on for a reason, to punish people. And I don't believe that either. But I do think that it seems to be more apparent that the reason, not the reason, that when these things happen, though, people do look to God. Think of how many times when somebody who might not even have a real spiritual sense of God or even study God, they get into a point in their life and they might actually say, oh, God, help me. You know, mm-hmm. please help me.
Yeah.
So I do think that when these things happen, it does bring us...
Testing.
Yeah, it's a test, but it's all, you know, it just makes... Think of how many times people come together, though, and people reach out to someone else. They might not have done that. People take... this woman was taken into a... Didn't know this. This family did not know this woman, a single mom and her kids, and they just said, we'll help somebody, and brought them into their home, completely trusting them, helping them, helping her find a job and all these things. So it does bring people together. Mm-hmm.
Pay attention on television. When a disaster happens, the person being interviewed is much more likely to mention God than when something good is going on.
Yes.
You know, when they release the new cars and everybody's looking at them at the beginning of the year, does anybody mention God? You know, isn't God a wonderful God?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, unless they're saying, please God, let me get one.
Yeah. Gwen?
I don't know. I just don't feel that the word God allows, I think, like you said, it's a sinful world and things will happen. I don't think that God is opening up or making things happen to us, but what he does do is he helps us to grow with the event.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Keep in mind that in the books of Moses, though, this comes up so often, and I believe the word punished is used there mm-hmm. at times, where the people sinned against God and he punished them. We have to remember that the bad things that happen in this world affect two different kinds of people. It affects unbelievers and it affects believers, right? And God has promised that for believers, there is no more punishment for sin left, right? Jesus paid for every sin when he died on the cross. So when we are faced with hardships as Christians, we should always view it as discipline, as chastening, but not as punishment.
It's not eternal punishment. Because we have the promise.
Yeah. It's pruning to make us
pruning.
Pruning, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But remember that there may be some people that he is directly punishing for sin.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
There was one thing here, it said that Moses asked that the covenant be read publicly every 7 years, and the people a song of praise. What was the song of praise that was used?
I'm not sure, Anna.
It's in the fourth paragraph.
On page
six.
Six. Fourth paragraph. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Song of praise.
And down near the bottom. Furthermore, Moses asked that the covenant be
reported to me
every 7 years. There we get that seven again.
He also gave the people a song of praise.
Okay. Well, Anna, I would say the best place to look is in Deuteronomy 31 through 33, because those, see how that always goes with a paragraph?
Yeah.
And you'll find the song of praise in there.
There was a song of praise and a song of warning. Mm-hmm. I feel like there were two paragraphs, there was two chapters that were songs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our bell is ringing, so make sure to get a copy of Lesson 7 for this upcoming week and enjoy the next books of the Old Testament.
I mean, I'm at a light speed into those books because I was going.